Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Thursday, March 26th. It's my mother's birthday today, and I better remember to call her. I don't get in trouble.
We have a phone right here.
Yeah. Sure you all want to wish happy birthday to my mom, right?
We can sing.
So,
courtesies of the Senate.
Courtesies of the Senate. I just wanted to let you know that the agenda schedule for today, because we're trying to juggle a lot of concerns and interests here. Senator Johnson cannot be here on SCR 9 for the work session 622 until 3:30. So we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 639. Then we're going to skip down to the work session on 201 and 79. And then we'll quickly, at 3:30, go back to SCR 9. And then last but not least, we will hear Senate Bill 676. Got that? So we will get through, hopefully, everything today in a timely manner. So with that, I'm going to...
7:39.
With that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. And Beth, if you can give us an overview, please.
Senate Bill 739 requires that upon accepting an offer, the seller of any real estate that includes a well that supplies groundwater for domestic purposes have the well tested for arsenic, requires that the seller submit the results to the buyer as well as the Department of Human Services, authorizes the department to adopt rules specifying additional contaminants that the seller must test for.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And colleagues, this is a committee bill. This is one of the bills that was introduced. There has been some work on this already done, but I think you're going to hear some other issues today. With that, I'm going to ask Gail Shibley, the Department of Human Services, and Greg Pettit to come up, please, and tell us why we need this bill or don't need it or what we should do with it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services. I've provided to the committee written copies of my testimony. In addition, you have, I think, here a fact sheet that is cryptically stated arsenic in privately owned wells. That is a fact sheet from Public Health. You also have one peer-reviewed paper on Oregon in community water systems, Demography Matters, by David Stone et al., and then also from U.S. EPA, Arsenic Occurrence in Public Drinking Water Supplies, that was prepared, I don't know if there's a date here, yes, December 2000, for the Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water. Just wanted to provide those to you for some kind of additional scientific information. I also do have a couple PowerPoint slides to accommodate the committee's very crushed schedule. I'll forego those unless you've got a burning desire to go through them. It does show on some just a couple maps. One is nationally kind of what Oregon looks like compared to other parts of the country, and then there are a couple snapshots for different parts of Oregon, the Willamette River Basin, Jackson County area, and then just as some context, some nitrate data points in terms of mapping. But
Gail, go ahead.
You've got that? Okay.
Are these the ones? Do we have copies of this as well?
Boy, I think
that's mine.
Oh, okay. That's courtesy of DEQ. But
yeah, but I think it would be helpful for the audience to see this as well.
Sure.
This is a public hearing, and I think if it helps,
you bet.
Demonstrate what you're trying to articulate.
Let me. This bill does three things, Madam Chair and members. Number one, it adds arsenic to a long-standing list of two environmental contaminants that sellers of property with domestic drinking water wells are required to test. Nitrates and total coliform bacteria have been on the books for many years now. This bill would add arsenic to that list, and I wanted to take just a couple minutes in terms of making the public health case about that. The second thing it does is add to the very short list of entities who are required to get that the test results to expand from DHS to also the buyer of the property. We want to provide that information directly to the buyer. There's no reason for it to go through other hands necessarily, just so that the buyer has that very important information. And the third thing that the bill does is allow us as public health entities to respond much more quickly and efficiently and nimbly to specific areas and specific contaminants of concern. Just a word or two about specifically about arsenic. It is a documented human carcinogen. Drinking water with high levels of arsenic can result in very serious health effects, including cancers. The International Agency for Research on Cancer has identified sufficient evidence in humans that arsenic causes lung, bladder, skin cancers. There's also evidence for associations with cancers of the kidney, liver, and prostate. In addition, high levels of drinking water arsenic have been linked to skin disorders, gastrointestinal diseases, circulatory and cardiovascular diseases, as well as chronic cough, shortness of breath, and other adverse respiratory effects. A particular concern from a public health standpoint is that arsenic can cross the placental barrier. Ingestion of high levels of arsenic by a pregnant woman may cause adverse reproductive and developmental effects in the fetus and has been linked to increased rates of stillbirths, spontaneous abortions, low birth weight, and even infant mortality. From a public health standpoint, therefore, the department is concerned about the number of Oregonians that may be consuming arsenic in their drinking water. While public water supplies must regularly test for arsenic and report those results to the department and make them public to their ratepayers, there is no such requirement for individual home wells. As many as 600,000 Oregonians rely on home wells for their drinking water, most likely do not know the level of arsenic in their water. This bill adds arsenic, therefore, to that list, requires that sellers provide the test results to the buyers of the property, and therefore helps protect the public health at no cost to the department and at very minimal cost in a real estate transaction. Further, Senate Bill 739 authorizes the department to propose and adopt rules requiring tests for other contaminants that may be of similar public health concern in a particular area in the future. Just wanted to show you, if I may, Madam Chair, see if I can run this. First is this is from the United States Geological Survey. Just wanted to share with you that that over and over again, what we have found is that arsenic concentrations in groundwater are generally higher in the western United States than other parts of the country. In large part, that's a geologic phenomenon where you have volcanoes, you have very likely the conditions, if you will, for arsenic. Within the Willamette River Basin, unfortunately, can't see this particularly well. I do have only one map here, but suffice it to say that these dots, whether they are pink or whatever other color is showing up there on the screen, are showing detections of arsenic within the Willamette River Basin. The pink are particularly high. In fact, they're over 50 parts per billion. Of course, the U.S. EPA has lowered the maximum contaminant level for arsenic from 50 to 10 parts per billion. As we know more, as science is better, we recognize just how pernicious the human health effect is of arsenic, and so that contaminant level has gone down. In Jackson County, we have very preliminary data. This was from our wonderful partners at the Jackson County Public Health Department. They did do some voluntary testing. These are individual private wells, looking at for about the past 13 years, I think, trying just to summarize for arsenic, fluoride, chloride, and nitrate, and sodium chloride. And I think the arsenic are the red circles there if they're showing up. So you see that it actually is, in fact, quite common. And as I believe, the numbers were something like 10% were detects, 5% were above the old level of 50 parts per billion. Again, five times higher than the current maximum contaminant level, and several of those wells were literally several thousand parts per billion. So extremely high levels. And then just to provide you a snapshot, if you will, for these are all nitrates, real estate transfer is the RET vernacular, real estate transfer private well water testing. This is for about the past 10 years. Again, because we have these data, we are able to identify just where we have some concerns. Guess what? We have a lot of concerns where we've got a lot of wells. And the big issue about this is really providing people the information that they need to take action. Changing this the statutory authority, we think can really provide us the opportunity to so that people can take action, and whether that's a different treatment technique, whether that's improving their well, upgrading the existing well, reciting a well, drilling another well in the same place. There are a variety of options that they've got. But Madam Chair, as the saying goes, you can't fix a problem you don't know about. This bill tries to get at that in a very efficient, clean way within existing structures. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn to my colleague here at the Department of Environmental Quality for any comments he might like to add.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I am Greg Pettit. I'm the administrator of the Department of Environmental Quality, Laboratory and Environmental Assessment Division. And I provided written testimony in order to take a time. I'm just going to try to hit it with the highlights here. I think it's important to know that there are 600,000 people in Oregon that depend upon these private wells as a drinking water supply. These wells are not covered under the Safe Drinking Water Act, and there's really no testing requirement for these wells other than what's required under the real estate transaction well testing requirement. Between 1986 and 2000, DEQ conducted some 45 regional groundwater assessments. We sampled some 1,156 wells for arsenic, and 24% of the wells that we sampled contain arsenic above the drinking water standard of 10 parts per billion. I provided a map, figure one, in my testimony, if you have it, that shows some of the results from our data. And the dots that are in red are the ones that exceed the drinking water standard. And you can see that although there are more occurrences of high arsenic concentrations in eastern Oregon than there are in western Oregon, pockets of high arsenic groundwater occur throughout the state. Out of those some 600,000 people that depend upon these private wells, I think many are simply unaware that there may be contaminants in their well that pose a serious health risk. And I think that this bill would be a very effective method for ensuring that the prospective well owners get some initial information about what the arsenic concentrations are in the well that will be supplying their drinking water, and then they can take appropriate precautions to protect their health. There are treatment systems that can be installed that can remove the arsenic and then go ahead and use the well. I've also included a map. It's the same map that Gail had, actually, which is of the nitrate data that we've collected through this real estate transaction testing program. And the red dots are the dots that exceed the nitrate standard of 10 parts per million for nitrate. And I use this as an example of the kind of information that we can collect through this program. This is particularly important, I think, in the times of the tight budget. In previous legislative sessions, we have lost all of our funding for doing these kind of regional surveys. The only funding we have left is the funding for the groundwater management areas. There are three of those, one in northern Malheur County, one in the lower Umatilla Basin, and one in the southern Willamette Valley, and that's the only place we're currently conducting monitoring. But through this requirement, we get the information from DHS, where they give it to us, we enter that data into a database, and then that's available to the public via the website. It's Northwest Water Quality Data Exchange. So it provides information not only for us, but for anybody that's interested in this. So you've seen a lot of data. I think the main point is there is high arsenic concentrations occur throughout the state, and they pose a very serious public health threat. I think our monitoring data strongly supports the need for this bill. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a couple of questions, but I'll see if any of my committee members have questions first. Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The premise is we need to test, and before you go to that, I would like you to comment on, I'm looking at your arsenic map, and obviously two things jump out at you. It ain't very healthy to live over in Ontario. That's the first thing. And the second thing
drink
is
drink water.
That's right. Well, Madam Chair, you have to drink water in Ontario because you're in the desert. So,
yeah.
So it's not healthy to live there. And the second thing that jumps out is don't move to Pendleton. I'd like you to comment, is there some man-caused natural habitat why do those two jump off the map right now? And then please follow up with, okay, I'm going to sell my house. Who do I call to do the test? How much does the test cost? And when I found out that my water is no better than Ontario, what's it cost me to get it treated?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist. We think that basically we're finding a lot of contamination in these private wells around the state. There's three primary contaminants we're finding: nitrates, pesticides, and arsenic. We think that the arsenic in most cases is naturally occurring. The nitrates and pesticides are human caused. However, there are certain locations where, like mercury or a lot of these things, are naturally occurring, but the problem can be exacerbated by human sources as well, because it's used for a number of industrial mining operations, pesticides, insecticides, even some fertilizers, and different things have arsenic as well that can contribute to the problem. I'm sorry.
Why?
It's a cost of test.
Oh, why Ontario? Well, we think it's primarily due to the geology in that area for the high arsenic. But the Ontario area has a number of groundwater problems. It has high nitrates. It has numerous pesticide detections as well. 60% of the wells we've tested over there have the pesticide Dacbal in them out of over some 300 wells. So, you know, the recommendations, obviously, if we're going to target an area for public outreach in terms of public health protection, recommendations for treatment systems and those kinds of things, this would certainly be a good area. And we've done that. We have a groundwater management area in that area.
Any other questions? Follow-up?
A few more questions he still has to answer. Who do I call to test the water? What's it cost? And then now that I live in Ontario water, what's it cost me to treat it?
The tests are going to run somewhere probably between $20 and $40 for the average test. I got some information. It's in my testimony. It says $10 to $20. I've talked to some additional people, and I think maybe that was a little bit low, but it's in that range of probably $20 to $40. I did get some quotes at $20 when I was looking into this. And I'm sorry, the second part of your question.
Now I have bad water. What's it cost me to treat it? You said there's
treatment systems for this, and I can't give you an exact figure on that. I know that this is one of the more difficult. I mean, there's a number of treatment systems that can be used to remove it, but it's not like the carbon filtration systems. It's some of the more sophisticated systems. And I'd hate to speculate, but if I was to speculate, I'd probably speculate in the area of something around $1,500 for a treatment system.
And Madam Chair, if I may add on to that, I think in large part, Senator Boquist, it really depends on what the level is and what your particular situation is. If you have, for example, a shallow uncased well and you have maybe 15 parts per million, then the type of treatment to get that below the 10 maximum contaminant level would be different than, for example, I'll pick on somebody outside of Sutherland, for example, where we know we have some very hot spots in an order of magnitude, about 500 or so parts per million. They may be looking at drilling a whole new well, or depending on their particular topography and geology on their property, they may not be able to use a well on their property. They may have to go to a community well or some other source for domestic water. There are also reverse osmosis systems, etc. So it really depends on the particular situation. I would hate to speculate too much, but the reality is that there are opportunities through the local public health department, through the state public health agency, DEQ, and others to be able to say, okay, what are some valid options here for us to work on?
Comment and then a follow-up on the last question here, and I think to grasp it, we really need to have a little better idea of the cost here. We're saying 600,000 wells here, and you mentioned these departments, and these departments, frankly, are on the chopping block. We have a budget crisis we're going on. I'm not sure the resources will really exist. But the final question I do have is there must be some geological. You said these are naturally occurring. So does the department or one of the departments have a scientific method of looking at an area and saying its arsenic is most likely to occur in this area? I mean, we've identified Ontario and stuff. I'm here. I mean, you said there's science and there's geological formations and all kinds of reasons. That leads me to believe there must be a scientific way to identify potential threat areas.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, we have looked at that. We've looked at the geology of certain areas, and we can estimate that certain areas are going to have a much higher risk of having arsenic than other areas. but I'm not sure that we can rule out any particular area from having high arsenic, because these groundwater quality can vary quite a bit from one location to another. Two wells might be right next to each other, and one might be high and one might be low.
And Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, in fact, that's exactly what we found. I mentioned Sutherland, and we've been doing some work voluntarily with the property owners there through a federally funded program, environmental health assessment program. And I'm sorry, I don't have the map with me today, but literally within perhaps a quarter mile, you will have a series of various wells, and some will be extremely high, some will be hardly a detection at all, and yet they're in the same geology, same watershed, the same. And so you're right, there are some geological kind of risk factors, if you will, but that doesn't necessarily say these people are going to have a problem and these people will not. And that's where you get down to, you just need to go and find out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I have a couple of questions and comments. And first of all, I just want to make sure I'm reading this bill right, because this would not require, for instance, going back 600 and retesting 600,000 wells. It's upon the time of purchase. Is that correct?
At the time this property is sold, there has to be a well test, and that information has to be provided to the new purchaser.
Okay.
And so it's only a requirement at the time of sale of the property.
Okay, and I'm sure, I know we're going to hear from the realtors, but do you have the numbers about how many transactions? I know it's less now, but per year we're looking at.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I don't have that number right in front of me, and it's been a while. I'll be happy to get you the very clear number directly from our data, but we only know, of course, what is reported to us. There well may be things happening that aren't in compliance with the law, but we simply don't know. But based on the data that we've got, as I recall, it was maybe a couple hundred as a high and down to a low of maybe 30 or 50. But again,
and this is under existing law that they're testing for nitrates and total coliform, and then they are submitting those results to the department, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And so what this does is adds arsenic to existing law as an identified contaminant of concern. Do you want me to repeat that? It just adds arsenic to the existing law as a contaminant of concern.
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay. And it says we're going to, instead of just having that information only come to the department and no requirement to go to the buyer, potential buyer, that information would be transmitted somehow electronically or through letter or whatever to the buyer.
That is correct.
Okay. So currently, if somebody has a well tested, well, they're required to have it tested for nitrates and total coliform, that information goes to the department. How does that information get to the potential buyer now?
Madam Chair, it wouldn't necessarily, and it doesn't. We of course don't necessarily interact on an individual basis as kind of a population-based health monitoring and risk assessment. Our focus really is in kind of zeroing in on and focusing in on and working with the local partners. Certainly, if somebody calls and they reach somebody, we'll do everything we can to assist them. But we are not there to be necessarily information broker from private party A to private party B.
Okay. And then just to follow up on Senator Boquist's point about having some geologic indicators, I mean, that is why we have a groundwater quality monitoring program, is to look at the aquifers and see if there's contaminants of concern. But my understanding is because of agency, budget cuts, that those programs have been cut back over the years. And certainly, I sit on the budget committee, so I'm very well aware of that. But that is a concern. It would be helpful if we have that groundwater monitoring data as an indicator for contaminants in those aquifers. So I don't know if you have any comments on that. You did mention in your testimony that program's been cut back, and so it's limited only certain aquifers
Senator
now.
Senator, I would respond that yes, that if we were able to, if we had funding to conduct these regional assessments, we'd have a better understanding. However, I think in the lack of that funding, that this proposal presents a very economic way of getting a good deal of information on arsenic concentrations around the state, and that can help us achieve the basic goal, which is to educate the public in those areas that have high levels of arsenic that they take the proper precautions.
Okay, and then finally, I happen to get my water from Portland Municipal Water Supply, and every year I get a report from the city that says this is what the results of our drinking water testing has shown. Obviously, if you're on a private well, unless you did those tests yourself, you would not have that information available to you about what's available in your
water. Madam Chair, that's exactly correct. Those reports are required under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Private wells are not covered under the Safe Drinking Water Act, or either from federal requirement or state requirement, and consequently, the drinking water from private wells, 1 to 3 connections, are entirely unregulated, except for at the point of transaction for these two contaminants, which we're suggesting ought to be augmented.
Okay, so we're talking about just under 20% of our population that's relying on these private wells for their drinking water supply.
Madam Chair, something close to that. We don't know the precise number, but we certainly work with our colleagues in the Water Resources Department. We think that's a pretty good number.
Okay. All right, thank you both. I'm sure there'll be some other questions, but we have a couple more people we're going to hear from before we close the public hearing. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might, just as I'm getting up, share that on behalf of the Conference of Local Environmental Health Supervisors, which are the local county public health, environmental health directors, if you will, they have all very strongly announced support for this. So I wanted to share that with the committee as well.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to call up all three of the next folks who want to testify. We actually have enough for three up here. Sean Jillians, Peggy Lynch, and Beth Myers. And then if there's anybody who hasn't signed up, we'll ask and see if anybody else does. Okay, Sean, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that on?
It is.
Yep.
There we go.
You're loud and clear.
There we go. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I appreciate the department's hard work on this bill. We met with them several times during the interim and tried to hash out all our differences on it. I think we're really close, but I don't know that we got there completely. We certainly think that testing for arsenic is a very positive thing for folks to do. It's just whether or not, what the timing of it. And Madam Chair, I think it kind of goes back to a conversation that you and I have had a bunch of times about people who live on domestic wells and whether or not there needs to be more education as far as water usage, what things they should have tested for. I think that's something that we really should be pursuing. As to the bill itself, the department mentioned that they wanted to be able to have the authority to have specific contaminants tested in specific areas. I would venture to say that the existing statute gives them that authority, and actually what the bill does is expand it much further and say that they can adopt rules for any tests or any contaminant in any part of the state. So throughout our discussions, I have expressed to the department, I think the existing statute is sufficient for their purposes, and if it turns out that statewide there needs to be additional tests, then certainly we'd come back here to talk to this committee or subsequent committee about adding to the statute of what needs to be tested for. The last point that I raised, Madam Chair, which is the new addition of to the buyer. And we're certainly not saying the buyer shouldn't be informed of it. We're just have a difference of opinion of we think that this test should go to the department if the department sees an issue with it, or if the person who's buying the property asks to see the results of it, that should be made available to them. The timing and disclosures are set in statute as it is right now for a real estate transaction. This would be something different from the timing and disclosure, so we're a little concerned about that. And the second thought I had on that one was an individual gets a test result that says you have arsenic in your well, it's at 2 parts per billion. Not myself personally would be scared by that. Even though that's safe levels, I would think, oh, I want to back out of this real estate transaction. This well is terrible. By sending it to the department has the certified smart people. that know that there's an issue there, and that's why I think it most properly belongs there. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. And I do want to follow up just quickly, and then we'll hear from the other two witnesses. So it sounds to me that you're not opposed to the buyer getting information, but it's more the sequencing of the information about having it go to the department first and there's some interpretation before it goes to the buyer?
I think that would be preferable. I think the only thing you run into there, Madam Chair, is disclosures and things like that. I think if we put something in here that says the buyer may request the information from the department, so the department knows that they're free to release those results, I think that would be a preferable way of wording it.
Okay, but I think that's already the case because it's public information. Anything that's going to the department, and I might have the department, we may have this conversation offline, but that would be my understanding. If it's going to the department, that would be public information.
Madam Chair, that was one of our topics of discussion during the interim. I would tend to agree with your assessment, but I think there may have been some hesitance on their part. I think if it was in the statute that they shall provide it to a potential buyer who requests it, I think that would make it easier legally.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Sean? Senator Przonski.
I'm sorry. Well, I just think I just heard was buyer beware. If the seller knows that there's a problem, isn't there a requirement to disclose, or is this not required in the disclosure for our transaction of a residence?
Madam Chair, Senator Przonski, under the current statute, you have a list of things that you have to disclose.
And arsenic, is that one of them?
It is. Arsenic is not currently something that you have to, because you don't have to test for arsenic at the point of sale right now. You have to test for coliform and nitrates. And so those things are things that are sent to the department. It's not part of the seller's property disclosure.
So the seller, the seller's disclosure does not require any notice to the potential buyer of any type of, let's say, drinking water issues with the house or property that's being sold. That's known by the...
That is correct. You missed that. That was a question I asked previously, and that is correct. And if you see in the existing law,
that's fine.
It's not required. Okay. Thank you. Senator Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if it were categorized differently, like the two parts per billion example you used, if it went back and it said it's either problem of concern or nothing, if it meets the level, I can see your issue with that. But is that what you would prefer? I guess how does it work with nitrates?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, in my perfect world, how would it work? The department gets all the results. They see that there's an issue somewhere, and they contact the person and say, "By the way, your well has an issue with it." I think now that since this is not currently in statute, the testing for arsenic, I think now someone who was selling their house previously wouldn't have known that. By adding it in there, they are going to know that now. So to get back to Senator Pazansky's question, it's an interesting question of now that we're requiring them to test for arsenic, would they be required to disclose that? Because previously they weren't required to test it. Honestly, I don't know the answer to that. Well, I don't, since we don't have that requirement right now.
Okay, Sean, then just this is sort of a follow-up on that. Currently required to test for nitrates and total coliform. So is that not required to be released as part of the...
No. Madam Chair, basically what they do right now is they have the test and they ship it off to the department.
Okay. So just to be clear, committee members, what this bill does is it adds arsenic to the already required... contaminants, nitrates, and total coliform. This is a problem that I found out about. This information goes to the department. There is no requirement that then that information gets into the hands of the buyer or the consumer. And so what this bill tries to do is fix that, not just for arsenic, but it would address all three. So, Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, I'm not a lawyer, but I have the Department of Human Services may adopt rules specifying additional contaminants for which the seller of the real estate must be have well tested. So I think it's arsenic and anything else they find in the future that they want to add to it. How it was kind of presented to me.
If there are rules, may adopt rules. It doesn't say shall. So.
Correct. Blank check.
Okay, so why don't we go on to Ms. Myers and Ms. Lynch.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League serves on the Drinking Water Advisory Committee for DHS, and we support this bill. We have recently done a water study, and as a part of our water study, we have also talked to our local leagues about their issues and concerns, and certainly the concerns with exempt wells and the water quality rose high on the list. A recent presentation by WRD said there are about 230,000 exempt use wells in Oregon. About 3,800 new wells are drilled each year, 550 in groundwater administrative areas. It seems to me that this is a reasonable request and a certain health hazard that ought to be addressed. The issues raised by the realtors, they now are required to tell us whether or not we have lead in our property. You can develop an information sheet that goes along with this information so that people understand what the parts per million mean and which ones are red and which ones are green. So I guess I don't see the barriers to this, and it frankly is something that is needed for the health of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Myers?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Myers. I have owned and operated Water Lab down the street here for 30 years. It's an environmental accredited laboratory. I'm in support of this Senate bill. I did have a handout, so you have my testimony. I did attach what you were talking about, which is the toxicological information from the DHS, in case you hadn't seen that yet, the blue, for your perusal. Gail talked about the lowering of the EPA limit, the maximum contaminant level, from 50 parts per billion to 10. And when that happened, a lot of wells that were in the public domain suddenly were over the limit, and so we've seen a lot of treatment, and I was really concentrating on that with my clients. And then the last few years, we've had people asking us for, you know, I want to test my water to see if it's safe. And these are people in the residential. Well, safe is a legal definition in Oregon in Chapter 333 in the OARs. And it means about $2,000 worth of testing, which the public water supplies do. So I can't do any water testing that's safe because that's such a legal definition. So I've had packages for years, so last spring I came up with this healthy water package, and with things that are around here, my main clientele is probably about 60 to 90 miles from Salem, and I included arsenic in that just because I thought it'd be a good idea, but I really didn't realize that there was very much arsenic in the area. So on the first page of my testimony, I put what we found. I had my staff look it up, and we have seen actually quite a bit of arsenic. It really surprised me. We have had people come in who've had high blood levels of arsenic, and then found they had high arsenic in their water, as Greg Pettit was talking about, sometimes 350 parts per billion up in the Lyons area. I think this is a serious health concern in Oregon. I think that the buyers need to know. My main problem is I think at the time of an offer is almost too late to deal with it, because then it starts the frantic part before a sale. I'd rather see them when they put their house on the market deal with it, because we see people all the time trying to deal with things at the last minute, and that seems to quash a sale. What we're seeing, when you were talking about how do people get their well results, right now what I know in our business is, say a drilling company brings in the sample, they get the report, they give it to the people, and then it goes to DHS. So actually DHS is kind of the last stop. So they don't need to report to anybody because they see it at the last stop. I want to remind you that a few lenders already require arsenic testing, so it's not like this is totally new. I think it's Veterans Affairs. Do you know which ones? And we already have requirements or lists from other lenders that already have it and require it. They just don't compile it anywhere. So we need data in Oregon. We need to know where the arsenic is. We have small children, we have elderly people. It's an important thing. I think it's the next step in what we need to know about the water for the residential client. I'll let you read most of my testimony. Arsenic was used, as Greg Pettit mentioned, in the old cherry orchard sprays. It's used in the creosote that's used in the railroad ties. People put these railroad ties around their garden. They irrigate with water that has arsenic in it, which arsenic then goes into the plants, the vegetables. There's more ramifications even than just the drinking water around us. A friend called me a few weeks ago, and her sister has bladder cancer and is in Florida, and the doctor knew immediately that it was related to the arsenic level. I guess mid-Florida has problems with arsenic in their drinking water, and especially with the lowering. So she was able to get fairly quick treatment and remedies and deal with the drinking water issue, and he moved her to different things. So my friend was questioning me about that, but it got me thinking, you know, we don't have that link here in Oregon. Our medical community doesn't know about arsenic. They don't know about the links with the data, because we don't have data in the general public domain about arsenic in water. So we don't have that link that other states do.
Since we have your testimony in front of us, are there other sort of final points that you want to make or make sure that emphasize for the
committee? Let me look real quick. Basically, I just think it is a family health issue, and I think we still get people in who think that you solve all problems with water by boiling it. Well, things like arsenic, you concentrate. So there is a lot of public education, like she said, that needs to be done.
Okay. Thank you very much, and appreciate you coming here today and your 30 years of experience with testing. Hearing your experience of that is very helpful. I do have a quick question for you. As you know, this would just add one more element that would be tested for. We currently have nitrates and fecal coliform, and this would add the third. Do you know what other states require for domestic wells? That would be something that would be helpful. Maybe we'll ask the department to provide that. But
no.
It seems like compared to, I know under the Safe Drinking Water Act for municipal water supplies, it's a huge, exhaustive list. It's a pretty long list. For domestic,
Madam Chair, I have it in here. It's 84 is the beginning requirement.
Right. It was in your testimony.
Items.
So we're only requiring, this would be three for private domestic wells.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Hold on. We have one more question. I'm sorry, Senator Boquist.
Beth, could you quickly speculate how many testing companies are in Oregon?
You know, I counted up. I think there would be, because that is a concern, I think there would be probably 10 available to the state.
Thank you, Madam.
These are people accredited in arsenic and drinking water.
And I'm sorry, I didn't see it in here. Here it is. As far as the cost for a typical test, it's about 30. Is that 35?
Right.
$35. Okay. Great. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else who would like to testify in Senate Bill 739? Jerry, come on up. State your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I represent the Oregon Groundwater Association. I wasn't going to testify today, but there was a few questions that I thought I could answer. One of my issues that I've been working with for the past 4 or 5 years is trying to get all the water treatment people licensed. There's a glitch in the rules. So in essence, there's a lot of folks out there doing water treatment that aren't licensed, and I'm trying to correct that as we speak. Just to answer some of the questions of the committee, they wanted to know what treatment alternatives are out there. It depends on whether you're doing a point of treatment or whether you're treating the whole issue. A point of treatment, you can use an RO unit. They routinely will run anywhere from $800 to $1,000 to install as a point of treatment. What I mean by that is that you put it by the kitchen sink and you can treat that water for drinking. However, that doesn't mean the bathroom is being treated. So that's one issue. If you're treating the whole thing, there's some very sophisticated treatments out there. It will cost anywhere from maybe a low of $2,500 to a high of $55,000 or $6,000. What you have when you're treating it with media is that you've got competing problems like iron and manganese, so you have to remove those as well, so it involves using a softener in front of it. The other issue is, what do you do with the media after you're done? That's still up for discussion. There is a couple of manufacturers that will take the media back and process the media, remove the arsenic, dispose of it in a hazardous waste facility, then ship the media back, but there's only two manufacturers that I know that do that. The RO unit, it discharges water filled with arsenic. Where do you discharge it? To a ditch or to a stream or to the septic tank? I don't know. Who has authority over this? I don't know.
Jerry, we're short for time,
okay.
So I'm going to one thing I just want to mention, this bill, just to be clear, it does not require cleanup of a contaminated well. It's a testing bill. And that's not to say that we don't want to encourage the cleanup if it shows levels that are exceeding the maximum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to answer some of those questions about the costs.
And if you could follow up with a handout in writing that we could have for our files, that would be really helpful. But I appreciate you coming up. And what I'm hearing is there's a range of options depending on the extent of the contamination and the complexity, obviously, of the groundwater situation.
That is correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry to go
That's
on.
Okay.
So I just tried to give you.
I appreciate that information.
Okay.
I know that Senator Brokaw had asked, and I just want to make it clear to the committee, though, that under this bill there is no requirement for cleanup. It's more of a right to know. However, certainly, if there was a problem, we'd want to encourage people
to clean
that up and not drink contaminated.
Yeah. And I'll answer the committee's questions later on. I'll be glad to chat with them.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate you coming up. Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739. We'll certainly be having some more discussions on this. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on SCR 9. Can I open up the work session as well? Or have to do that separately? Okay. Beth, if you can give us a brief overview, and then we have Senator Johnson that would like to comment on the resolution.
SCR 9 honors David Lett's vision, dedication, and decades of effort that he put into laying the foundation for the Oregon wine industry, and it extends condolences to the family of David Lett.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, apologize for the wait, but I'm sure you learned more than you needed to know about arsenic, and we'll go home and test your well right now if
Absolutely.
You're not
in the Just as long as it's not in the wine. That's For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I am the state senator from District 16 and a proud friend of David Lett's. I come before you today. You've got all the whereases that detail the remarkable life of an Oregon original. Not only was David Lett a vintner, a bon vivant, an advocate, a bit of a raconteur, an all-around good guy, but he was literally at ground zero in the creation of Oregon's $1.5 billion wine industry. He passed away way too soon. A memorial service attended by 1,000 people in McMinnville. It was the only memorial service that I've ever attended where they gave you a program and a wine glass at the same time. And this whole assemblage toasted him with one of his fine, fine, rare Chardonnay vineyards. Great way to say goodbye to a wonderful man, and I think it is appropriate that this legislative assembly memorialize his dedication to the wine industry and recognize in front of his family his manifold contributions to Oregon.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, for bringing this forward. Any comments or questions from the Senator?
Great wine.
Okay, thank you.
We can only wait for the floor session.
Yes. And, Senator Johnson, we have a couple more people that would like to come up, but I'm hoping you can stick around because
I will absolutely stick around. I'll sit over here in the cheap seat.
Oh, work session. We only have the high-paying seats in this committee room. Okay, Mr. Conkling and Mr. Stacey. We are in the revenue, isn't this? We're Ways and Means, so. Mr. Conkling?
I think someone called out.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bob Stacey, 1000 Friends of Oregon. I saw Mr. Conkling down in the land use hearing room in the House side in 50. He may be up in a moment. I want to lend 1000 Friends support and my personal support to this resolution and urge that the committee approve it for send it to the floor for passage. David Lett's accomplishments in the wine industry are enumerated, probably overly modestly, in this resolution. And there's an allusion to his experience in land use planning as well. Scarcely had David and Diana started to see grapes growing on the vines that they planted in the mid-60s in the Red Hills of Dundee, after David defied all the certified smart people in the wine business by picking that location.
Gary asked me to fill in for him.
Okay, thank you.
Then David learned that the Anhill County Planning Commission was considering zoning designations for the Dundee Hills of very low-density residential, which was essentially sort of a two-acre minimum lot size rural residential zone. David, along with Dick Ponzi, David Adelsheim, and other leaders of the new emerging industry, started working hard to persuade the Planning Commission, the planners, and the County Commission that this was indeed farmland and not marginal land that was only suitable for home sites. That kind of debate about what's farmland and what isn't, about what's marginal, about the utility of land, is one that we've never left since. But the experience of the vintners in Yanhill County was very instructive for a lot of people. For David, it turned into a lifetime and passionate commitment to strengthening the protection of agricultural land in Oregon. And 1,000 Friends of Oregon was honored to have David as a member of our board of directors for 30 years and until his passing in October. We earnestly encourage you to adopt this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stacey.
Hi. Hannah Smith. Gary Conklin wanted me to say that the Oregon Wine Growers Association supports this as recognizing one of the industry's founding pioneers.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else that would like to comment on this resolution? All right, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on SCR 9, and I will open up a work session on SCR 9 and entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd move SCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves SCR 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes and SCR 9 is adopted. And Senator Johnson, would you be so kind as to carry this to the Senate floor?
Thank you for the courtesy. Okay,
thank you. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on SCR 9. And I'm actually going to open up a work session while Senator Johnson is here on Senate Bill 622. Beth, if you can remind us about this bill, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 622 creates the Task Force on Geese Control to study issues raised by the increasing number of various species of geese and make recommendations on how to control the geese population. Also, just to refresh your memory, there is the Dash 2 amendments that we're considering today that adds a requirement that one of the 9 members appointed to the Task Force on Geese Control by the State Fish and Wildlife Director represent aviation, as well as expands the Task Force recommendations to include the impact of geese populations. And, of course, the no revenue and minimal expenditure impact statement on these.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. We are in a work session. I will entertain a motion.
Question, Madam Chair, does the Dash 2 include me in an over and under?
That's a shotgun.
Yes, I know. I was going to say that's up to the interpretation of the person making the motion.
Move the Dash 2s.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 17, 2009. Is there any discussion? Senator Johnson, do you want to add?
Good task force should be created.
Yeah. Okay. We have the department here. I wanted to ask the department to come up and see if they wanted to add any comments about the amendment, and then we'll take another motion.
Take a shot at it.
Yeah.
Chair Dean Felder, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. We have no problem with the Dash 2 amendment. We feel it's appropriate and would look forward to working with the group.
Okay. So any other discussion or questions? All right. Any objection? If not, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 622 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson slings this one towards the committee. He moves Senate Bill 622 is amended with the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. Any questions? Well, since we have the agency here. Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, actually, on this one. I keep looking over that way.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Fazonski?
Aye.
Senator Hack?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. So with that, the motion passes, and the bill goes to the floor, Senate Bill 622, as amended with the dash 2s. And Senator Johnson, I think it's your lucky day.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to carry this one as well?
Thank you.
I need Senator Atkinson there to...
Yes, I think he needs to ride shotgun on this one for you. All right, thank you. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 622. And actually, because we have so many people here from far away, over 100 miles, what I'd like to do is open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 676, and then we will do the work sessions because it's mostly agency and people that I see in the audience that are often in this building. And I think that as a courtesy, we will make sure that people came far away are heard first. So with that, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 676. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Senate Bill 676 authorizes the production, possession, and commerce in industrial hemp commodities and products, identifies that industrial hemp is an agricultural product that is subject to regulation by the State Department of Agriculture.
Okay, and Senator Przonski, since your name is on this bill, along with Senator Nelson.
Yep, Senator Nelson's here. I think he was going to.
Okay, Senator Nelson, why don't you come on up?
I'm actually going to make a phone call to
Representative Monson.
Yes,
to Monson. We have a representative, the Republican Speaker of the House in North Dakota, who's going to join us. North Dakota.
Aren't they having a bit of a problem there?
Yes,
right?
They're sort of underwater. But
that's from World War II.
Yes, he's. Maybe their phones are underwater.
Hello?
Yes, hi. Is this Representative Monson?
Yes, it is. I'm going to put you on hold and put you on my speakerphone.
Uh-oh. You're on speakerphone as well, so just so you know.
Okay.
And this is Senator Jackie Dingfelder here from the Oregon Legislature.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us and welcome.
Yes.
Representative Monson is the Republican Speaker of the House in North Dakota, and we know that you're dealing with severe flooding and storms right now, so we appreciate you being with us, and our thoughts are with you. Water is a very important issue to this committee, and obviously it's something that I know you're dealing with right now.
Yes, we are having a bit of a problem here. We did get our ice jam broken up with about 600 pounds of explosives, and the water in the river has gone down about 3 feet now, so I think we're past the worst of it for right now.
Well, good. Well, we're glad you can join us, and we're glad you're not in a boat or you're able to be dry on land. We do have the two senators that are co-sponsoring this bill, and we've asked them to say a few comments before we hear public testimony. So we have Senator Dave Nelson here and Senator Floyd Przonski.
Very good.
Thank you. Okay. And then we'd like to hear your testimony, but I know you wanted to hear from the senators first.
Yeah.
Who would like to go first?
Madam Chair, just for the record, since Representative Monson's on the telephone, this is Senator Floyd Przonski. And I just wanted to say, kind of mirror what Representative Monson will be telling us as to long haul and endeavor as trying to give our farmers here in Oregon the opportunity to have the ability to grow industrial hemp. It has a very long history and heritage, industrial hemp, not only in this state, but many other states, including North Dakota. And in looking at the prepared remarks that Representative Monson will be sharing with us, it appears that he has been the primary sponsor, as I have, for industrial hemp in his home state of North Dakota. And he will be going over as to when it first was introduced and the trials and tribulations and why North Dakota has taken the steps that I'm asking Oregon to do, and why I would say at this point it is imperative for us to move sooner than later, because there is going to be, I believe, a recognition on the part of the federal government to open up what has been in the past a legal crop that would allow farmers in this state to have the opportunity, if they chose to, use it in their production and as a rotation crop. Has, as I said, a very long history. We have a number of individuals that are here that have different expertise regarding their the use of industrial hemp. What I can tell the committee at this point, in the state of Oregon as well as throughout the United States, it is illegal for farmers to grow industrial hemp unless they go through a very rigid process that DEA has to sign off on. And at the same time, we can have manufacturers and production individuals import as much industrial hemp as they can and they desire to from any other countries. And I believe Representative Monson will share his experiences as to what's happened to the north of them in Canada. So with that, I'm going to turn over the microphone to Senator Nelson and let him make his statements, who is a co-chief sponsor in this year's effort. And then we're honored to hear from the Speaker of the House of North Dakota.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Przanski. And Representative Monson, I just want to make sure, can you hear us okay?
Very good.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Senator Nelson, welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, and honorable representative from North Dakota. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, which is Northeast Oregon. I'm a dryland farmer, but my district has dryland and irrigated farmer for both, and so I would have to declare a conflict of interest because I potentially could grow this crop at some particular time. And that's really my interest, just to give farmers another opportunity, another option. In our part of the country, dryland farms are getting bigger and bigger. The irrigated farms are getting bigger and bigger, and small farms like my son and I operate are trying to find niches and so that we can survive. And so that's my interest in this bill, and I'm looking forward to listening to the representative from North Dakota talk about his experience on the ground raising this crop. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And with that, Representative Monson, why don't you go ahead? We're delighted you can join us.
Okay, thank you, Representative Senator Dean Salander, is it?
That's it, you got it right.
Okay, for the record, I'm State Representative David Monson from District 10 in northeastern North Dakota, and I am the Speaker of the House here. I'm a Republican. I've been in the legislature since 1992. And I believe you have my written testimony, and I'm not going to bore you with reading it. I guess I'll just hit a few of the highlights. In North Dakota, we have a citizen legislature that meets every 2 years for a maximum of 80 days.
Whoa.
So we're under a real time crunch here in North Dakota when we get into session. And obviously, we are not full-time legislators, so in my real life, throughout my whole career, I've been a school administrator, and I've been a farmer since 1975 with my dad, who passed away recently, but we have been working on this project for industrial hemp since 1997. That was the first legislative session that I introduced a bill, and we have passed every bill that we've ever put in. We've been tweaking it every year since 1997, and your bill looks very, very comprehensive. I think you're going to catch up to what we have done in North Dakota in almost one fell swoop if this bill were to go into law. It looks very, very good to me. I believe you've been told, or you can read in my testimony, that we are in the middle of a lawsuit against the DEA. Another farmer and I have had North Dakota licenses issued by our Ag Commissioner, Roger Johnson. He is a Democrat, and he has been working very hard with us all the time that we've been working on the whole issue. We've made many trips to other states and to Washington, D.C., and we are currently without Roger because he was just elected to the position of the National Farmers Union president. So we are looking at a new ag commissioner being appointed shortly, and I would think that we're going to have a pretty good relationship with him, too, as far as the industrial hemp issue goes. We've had great bipartisan support. We've had very large margins when we pass our bills. They all pass with 75% to 85% of the people in both houses voting for them. And it's an issue, I guess, of states' rights, but it's also very important to us agriculturally because we have been, especially in my corner of the state, very wet for many years, and we have a disease called Fusarium head blight in our wheat and barley, and we call it scab, and it has let up a little bit. We found some fungicides that we can use to help control it somewhat in some years, but it's very important that we find some other crops that we can rotate in to try to break our disease cycle. And we have great hopes for industrial hemp because they're raising it just 25 miles away from me up in Canada. They've been raising it since 1997, and they've had growing pains with it. It's not the easiest crop to harvest. It's very tall, very strong fibers, and it's got some challenges, but they have worked through that, and we've learned from them. We are very hopeful that in the near future, maybe the new president here, administration, will relax the rules and regulations against industrial hemp. There are tests that can be done to show the difference between marijuana, the high THC levels, and the industrial hemp. And they're pretty simple. They're even a field test, and we just can't seem to get through the DEA, though, that there is a difference between industrial hemp and marijuana. And their whole contention is that if it's in the same genus and species, if it's got any trace of THC whatsoever, it's marijuana, plain and simple. So I guess I'll just let you ask me some questions if you have any, and see where we go from here.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions? Senator Boquist has a question. I'll identify as they, obviously you cannot see them unless you're watching us on cable, but go ahead, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. Could you expand just briefly, the issue at hand here is even once the state passes this law, then what we're doing is adding our weight so that at a future date when we either convince the DEA or we convince the federal government, as you're well aware, the 2007 Act Ron Paul introduced to overturn the law is out there. We're really positioning ourselves so that we can get into the commercial production like our neighboring nations are right now. Is that not correct?
I would say you are 100% correct. By other states passing industrial hemp legislation, I think that will bring more pressure to bear on DEA or the administration and Congress to make the changes that are needed. And once we've got the laws in place on the books, we feel that we have an upper hand. I guess we're ready to go if that day ever comes that the DEA and Congress say, okay, go ahead. If you've got state regulations in place, we'll let you run your own show.
Follow-up question from Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Representative, just looking at this and the research that I did in preparation for the committee, could you comment on the oil value? I see that there are some minor oils, but is there a biofuels value to this crop?
Madam Chair and Senator, I would say that the value of the industrial hemp crop as an oil is probably going to be too valuable to use as a biofuel at this point. It sells for about 80 cents a pound right now, and you can use soybean or canola, which is a big crop in our area, much cheaper, and 15 cents a pound for canola probably, and it will burn just fine. So I would say that the value of industrial hemp as a biofuel is not that great using the oil. However, the biomass that can be used in an ethanol plant to make ethanol is far superior to corn or any other annual type of a crop that we can raise, like switchgrass and corn and so on.
Any other questions? Senator Przanski.
Thank you. Representative, again, thank you very much for taking time out of your day with all the, I'm going to call it tragedies that you've been dealing with in your home state. I want to put on the record, I assume that through your research, you realized that industrial hemp was, in fact, a cash commodity crop that we've had in this country for decades, and it wasn't until, I believe, 1970-71 when the federal government took over the controlled substance and passed that act that basically knocked out the legitimacy of that crop. And I was wondering if you could just share with us maybe some of the discussions you had with your colleagues and maybe some of the historical perspective as to industrial hemp being used. I know that there was the Hemp for Victory campaign during World War II, having farmers to grow hemp to help with the war cause during World War II, and that there are actually commercial milling and facilities that were in existence up into at least the early 60s.
You're right on all those counts. The state of North Dakota was actually a very large industrial hemp producer through World War II, and I believe that was about the last crop that was legally raised here in North Dakota. We have a lot of volunteer industrial hemp still growing. They call it ditchweed. It grows wild in a lot of parts of the state, especially in the southeastern corner of the state. And for a long time, the DEA and our state weed boards were out there eradicating it because it was considered a noxious weed. So in one of the years that we've been working on this issue, we did take industrial hemp off the noxious weeds list. Our counties were very happy to not have to go out and spend all kinds of dollars and time trying to eradicate the volunteer industrial hemp that was still growing left over from the 40s. So now, since that has happened, they don't even bother to spray it anymore, and we're hoping that that could be a real valuable germ source for our industrial hemp in the future. You know, just to, we know it grows very well here because it's been surviving on its own for 70 years, 60 years.
Okay. Senator Nelson has a question or a comment.
Yes, thank you, Representative. Growing conditions, is it irrigated, dry land, the amount of water that you probably need, is a spring crop or a fall crop, and what it would be an average yield, say, in any one of those conditions?
Okay, you were cutting in and out a little bit, but average rainfall in my corner of the state is anywhere from about 15 inches in the summer on up to about 40 inches in the summer. Anything around 20 seems to be adequate. The people up in Canada, just a few miles north of me, are almost the same amount of rainfall, and no matter how much or how little rain they get, it seems like it does very well because it's got a very good taproot. It takes about the same amount of fertilizer as wheat. It does not take any pesticides or herbicides because, as far as we know yet at this time, there are no insect pests. It grows so fast that it shades out all of the weeds. I went up to Canada and I saw on my friend's farm where they were doing some different experimenting. They planted it anywhere from 6-inch rows all the way up to 36-inch rows, I believe, at least 30-inch rows. And they had virtually no difference in the yield. They found, though, that the fiber is much finer and of a higher quality if they plant it closer together, and it doesn't grow quite as tall, and that's one of the problems with harvesting it, is because it can grow so tall that it's very tough to harvest.
What would be an average yield? Or
they've been getting about 800 to 900 pounds of seed per acre, and about 80 cents a pound, roughly. You know, it varies like every other commodity, but it seems to be pretty stable around that price. That yields them about $700 an acre gross, and then when they come in and harvest the stalks and for the fiber, then that brings their gross value, I guess, per acre somewhere around the $800 to $900 range.
Thank you.
Okay. And Senator Pozanski had another question.
Yeah, Representative, I just want to, I guess, get some clarification. It sounds like one of the things that you're looking at, the ditchwidge that you have, that could actually be the formation of your seed bank that you would need to be able to grow. So our legislation actually would allow farmers to maintain or retain, I should say, some of the seed for the next crop, for the next year. And do you find that to be important to be able to establish and maintain their ability to continue to grow by retaining some of the seed?
Well, we do have another farmer here that holds a license, and he has indicated that he wants to raise it for seed for other farmers. I am so close to Canada that I applied for a DEA license to import seed from Canada. And they have done quite a lot of research around the world. Finland has a seed that is very common now up in Canada. It's called Finola. It has pretty good characteristics with the oil. It's not nearly as tall. And I think for the most part, we would be getting seed out of Canada to start with. We do have provisions, though, that we could keep it on our farms to use it ourselves, or hopefully to buy it from other people that raise the certified seed. But the ditchweed hasn't been tested, to my knowledge, as to what the level of THC is. I've been told it's quite low, but you know, that would have to be tested and verified before we could start using that, because our law says 0.3% THC or less.
All right. One last question, if I could, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the issue of, let's say, the cousin of marijuana. There's been a lot of discussions in the past, Representative, regarding that you are going to have individuals that are going to try to maybe grow marijuana in the middle of a industrial hemp seed plantation or plot. And it's my understanding that that would be somewhat foolish for multiple reasons. One, of course, the legislation we have requires these farms to be registered and they can be inspected. And so asset forfeiture laws would actually kick in if someone was actually doing that. And also, if you're actually growing marijuana for high THC, understand that there would be a cross-pollination that would occur with industrial hemp that would actually work against an individual who was actually trying to produce marijuana.
You're correct. I want to make sure, though, that you understand that if you were to plant a plant of marijuana in the middle of your field, that that plant is bred or has the genetics to produce a high level of THC, and it would cross-pollinate, but the actual leaves or seeds or whatever they use for the marijuana drug purposes would still be high in THC until the second generation, where the seeds from that plant would be planted and used to make the next crop. The mere planting of it in the middle of the industrial hemp field will not dilute that first plant, you know, the THC level of that plant. It's if they tried to save the seed from that and use it, then obviously it will have been cut way back in quality. I want to add, though, that Winnipeg, Manitoba, pretty large population, a million plus, and then all the suburbs around it. They had a field in 1997 of industrial hemp planted right around what they call the Perimeter Highway. And a lot of kids from Winnipeg evidently came out the first year, and they were stopping on the highway, running out into the field, and they would snip off the leaves all summer long, and the poor field along the road looked like it had a hailstorm go through it. The next year they planted a field similar in the same vicinity. Nobody even touched it. Nobody looked close at it at all. Totally left it alone. So they found out that it had zero value as far as drugs go. I guess that pretty well answered most of your question, I hope.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you for being here. And we do have your written testimony that's been distributed to the committee.
Well, thank you very much for letting me testify. And I would have liked to have been there in person so you could actually meet me and I could show you that I am a real person. I am not a hippie by any means. I have no ulterior motive other than strictly the production of the fiber and the seed for food and for fiber uses. And I'm just an ordinary kind of guy, just like you guys.
Well, thank you very much, Representative. We certainly appreciate you taking the time out, especially during in the middle of the crisis that you're dealing with. And you're welcome to stay on if you'd like to hear the rest of the testimony.
Actually, I have you pulled up on my computer, so I will just I'll hang up the phone, and I will be here for a little while. I do have a dinner engagement in a little bit, but I'll watch on my computer and... if you do have other questions, you could call me back, or you can certainly call me back again on Monday or Tuesday. And I did give my cell phone number to you, too.
Okay. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking the time, and we look forward to, if we have any follow-up questions, contacting you.
Okay. Thank you very
thank
much
you.
For letting me do this.
And thank you, Senator Nelson, for coming here today. And you're welcome if you'd like to come up to the dais and hear the rest of the testimony.
I just like the concept of a hippie Republican.
There you go. Thank you. So we have a couple of panels, and I am going to ask folks that they can limit their testimony to 3 minutes each because we still have two work sessions to do before the end of the evening. So next panel is David Siebert, Christina Volgesi, I'm hoping I got that right, and Gary Shapiro. And I'm going to hand the gavel to my trusty vice chair, and I'll be right
back.
That's
it. I am trusty.
I didn't say trustworthy.
All right. Thank you. Whoever wants to go ahead.
Okay, hi. My name is Dave Siebert, and my company is Fiber Alternatives. Please let me thank Senator Floyd Brzezinski and the committee for the opportunity to present this information, which is based on my poster entitled 21st Century Hemp Composites and Energy Applications, and an accompanying PowerPoint presentation, which will be available through Senator Brzezinski's office. It's right up there, or at the above addresses. What this poster says is that hemp grown densely up to 18 feet with no side branching or plant spacing, chopped to whole green stalk pieces, 1/4 to 1/2 inch, and dried to produce feedstock or furnish, can be made into biofuels, biochar, and building material composites. Why industrial hemp? Yield. Hemp is the only annual fiber energy source plant that produces enough material to replace the biomass currently extracted from forests and food producing sources on a sustainable basis. Hemp can produce 10 to 15 tons of biomass per acre on secondary and tertiary growing areas. The composition, hemp stalks are 77% cellulose, and the lignin is soluble with hydrogen peroxide. Since our forests are the second most important carbon sinks on the planet next to the oceans, how can we hope to sequester excess carbon dioxide if we keep removing the trees from our forests? Industrial products such as biofuels and biochar have three processes that are currently being considered: distillation, biodigestion, and pyrolysis. Hemp is the best source of annually renewable ag biomass we have. Pyrolysis, which is non-oxygen combustion, currently has the most potential to produce biofuels. While infrastructure investment for pyrolysis is prohibitively expensive, the biochar side product holds tremendous potential to eliminate nutrient runoff in fields and to supplement and eventually replace organic and petroleum-based fertilizers in agriculture. Hemp for composite building materials. Hemp is as good as or superior to wood fiber in all current applications such as particle board, MDF, OSB panels, laminated veneer lumber, structural beam components, and can be produced with minor modifications in the mills as they are. It is a good reinforcement for thermoplastic resin fiberglass applications, and a report on these topics entitled Bass Fiber Applications for Composites is linked to www.fiberalternatives.com website. Hemp and lime can be mixed to make a spectrum of building materials ranging from blown insulation, plasters, panels, structural members, aggregates and sealants for walls and floors, etc. These products make buildings and structures that absorb CO2 over time while creating super comfortable interior environment temperatures with walls that actually breathe. In conclusion, hemp is an ideal material for making biofuels and biochar for agriculture, to mitigate global warming and forest degradation, to stabilize the world and Oregon's economy, to revolutionize building materials, construction technologies, and costs, and to provide green-collar jobs and employment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was impressive. Thank you.
And that was said within 3 minutes?
That was very good. We'll hear from the entire panel, and then we'll take questions. Go ahead.
Okay. Senators, and I'd like to thank Senator Przanski and Senator Nelson for sponsoring this bill. My name is Jerry Shapiro. I'm the owner of the Mary Hempsters. I'm incorporated. Been incorporated in Oregon for 12 years, and this is going to be my 16th year in business. Last year, we did about $2 million in retail sales. We are on track to do a little better this year. It's kind of flat. It's tough out there. But, you know, we have a good business model, and I believe hemp really is, I believe, holding its weight. I mean, it's shown that it works, and here I am 16 years later and, you know, presenting this before you. I submitted the testimony. It's pretty clear. I'll just let you guys, you know, read it. I just want to have the opportunity to come in front of you and encourage you to pass the Senate bill. That's it.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me here. My name is Christina Volghese, and I'm one of the founding partners of Living Harvest Foods. We are the largest manufacturer of natural and organic hemp food products. We're Portland-based. Our product line consists of hemp milk, the first hemp milk-based ice cream, and we will have some sampling after the hearing for you all, as well as making hemp oil and hemp protein powders. Okay. All our products are made from imported Canadian-grown hemp seeds. To date, only our ice cream line is manufactured in Oregon, with the rest of our products being manufactured in Canada or out of state due to the lack of hemp seed sourcing and processing facilities in Oregon. We support hemp farming legislation in Oregon because we believe in the economic opportunities hemp farming will produce for local farmers and businesses. Since the launch of hemp milk in January of 2007, hemp foods have become one of the fastest growing trends in the natural foods industry, experiencing double-digit growth of 34% year over year. We've tripled our sales since the launch of hemp milk, and we expect to reach just under $8 million in revenue by year's end, a 60% increase versus the previous year. And to accommodate our growth, we are putting more Oregonians to work. We have expanded our infrastructure. We currently employ 14 people, and we've just moved to 3,000 square feet of office space in downtown Portland. I don't know if you've had a chance to try hemp foods before, but 15% of our national sales are driven by consumers here in the Pacific Northwest. You can find our products in Fred Meyer's, QFC, Hagen, Market of Choice, New Seasons, Whole Foods Markets, and natural food retailers like Life Source and First Alternative here in Salem. And by year's end, we will be available in Winco, C&K Markets, and pretty much every local grocery chain in the state. And due largely to our success, we are now seeing established food manufacturers adding hemp to their portfolio products. Companies such as Bob's Red Mill and Pacific Foods, both Oregon-based companies, as well as food giants such as Hain Celestial, a $1 billion food company, and Rich's, a $2.5 billion food company now selling hemp foods. These companies, like ours, are all purchasing hemp seeds from Canadian farmers. We believe there's a huge economic opportunity, which we are realizing today, for Oregon farmers to grow hemp to support the natural products industry. Our business growth and the growth of the hemp industry is driven by consumers' recognition that hemp is a delicious and highly nutritious food source. Hemp seeds contain naturally occurring healthy omega-3 fatty acids, high-quality digestible protein, and vitamins and minerals like iron and magnesium. And importantly, hemp is also free of common allergens. It's gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free. Many Americans, as you know, are facing health-related issues today and need hemp food products. The population of consumers who cannot drink soy milk or dairy is growing. It's estimated to be between 30 and 50 million. Both soy milk and dairy are actually considered top 8 allergens, according to the FDA. And the number of consumers allergic to gluten is also on the rise. So hemp food products fill this niche. Also, we're finding that consumers nationwide are voting with their dollars for natural and organic hemp foods. In conclusion, I'd like to tell you that we expect in the next 5 years to reach $100 million in revenue, all from hemp food products. And we would like Oregon farmers and businesses to be the ones who benefit alongside of us. We would like to, hemp farming, we believe, will lead to further economic development as well of local food processing and manufacturing facilities. We don't want to rely on imports any longer in foreign and out-of-state food processing. And we don't want to be forced to move our manufacturing up to Canada because of increased transportation costs and the cost of importing raw hemp seeds. So we sincerely hope the hemp farming legislation will pass in Oregon so we can localize our seed sourcing, processing, and manufacturing in the state and share our economic benefits with Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I apologize for being out of the room for a couple minutes and wanted to see if there were any questions from the panel. Okay, Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a question
for the panel. Yeah.
For Jerry or Christina. Just for the record, Madam Chair, I'm looking at the Congressional Research Service report for the Congress. It's actually dated March 23, 2007. And I'm looking at your testimony and the Canadian documentation, along with I did review the Hemp for War video that Senator Prozanski mentioned, in which we went from about 10 or 12,000 acres to about 75 or 80,000 acres in less than 1 or 2 years. The Congressional Research Report indicates that U.S. imports in 2006 of hemp products was about $6.3 million, and that about $1.2 million of that came from Canada. Both of you are in the industry. Can you kind of expand? I mean, it appears to me the numbers don't match and that there's actually a larger market out there. So if in a state like Oregon or North Dakota you started producing this, that the market is actually much larger. Would you comment on that?
I can make a comment on that. Hemp actually can
be... Can you state your name for the record folks who are listening? Yeah.
Christina Volgese with Living Harvest Foods. Hemp is a versatile ingredient raw material source. It can be made into a variety of products. So currently we see our growth not only in the hemp milk beverage category, ice cream, but really any food category where we can where you see soy being used. So soy isolates as a filler in many different food categories. So we do see the growth of hemp food products increasing exponentially, and there is the fact that Hain Celestial and Rich's, so these are $1 billion food companies, are starting to manufacture foods with hemp is a good indication that there is a huge economic opportunity.
Follow up?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In your testimony, Christina, you indicated on page 2 that over a 5-year period you thought there was a $100 million revenue market.
That's for our business. So it's within reach within 5 years. We believe that we will do $100 million in revenue 5 to 6 years from now from product expansion as well as expansion of distribution into new chains, food service, conventional grocery. Right now we're in the natural food space and moving into more grocery chains like Fred Meyer's and C&K Markets and such.
Thank you, Andrew.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Senator Prozanski.
Now, Jerry, and your company, you didn't really, let's say, tell it what you do. I do have one of your lip balms.
So. Yeah, I thought I saw you using that. So, Jerry Shapiro, Mary Hempsters, we produce a hemp oil-based lip balms, medicinal salves. We also started a new line of products called Sacred Earth Botanicals, which we've been focusing on spas and massage schools, and it's really starting to take off. It's not so much hemp-centric, but we do use hemp in many of the products. So,
And if I could follow up.
Follow up.
And as you said, from your early days, starting with what I understood was just the lip balms, you've now expanded into these other markets. And do you also, as Christine say, see more opportunities?
Absolutely. We actually are primarily in the natural food industry. We've had a lot, I mean, we kind of have a double niche here in that we have a point of purchase product that allows us to put it just about at any counter space or at ski hills. And but the spa products, that is for us really where we see our future going, and that we're not just hemp based but also certified organic, one of the few in the country through Oregon Till.
So. Great. Yes,
I'd like to make a comment in that I was directly involved in the legalization of industrial hemp in Canada. When you receive your poster, you'll see a picture of a piece of MDF here. The first license that was granted in Canada was on an experimental basis, and someone had to, it was on the provision that someone had to take the raw stock and make it into an industrial prototype. I was sent the raw stock, which we then sent to Washington State University Materials and Engineering Lab, where we made medium-density fiberboard out of it, which when was sent back to the Canadian farmer and placed into the hands of the Canadian government representative, industrial hemp became legal in Canada. And I would just point out that while there's no accounting for the history of what's happened with industrial hemp, that hemp works better or as well in all our mills that produce building materials and composites right now. How much is the amount of hundreds of millions of dollars of products that we're talking about that could be used through our mills alone and all the composites that are placed there?
Okay, thank you for that additional comment.
Madam Chair, just really quickly,
because we have a lot of people upstairs.
I just wanted to kind of support what is happening with this hemp milk is really fantastic, and this is going to put hemp really on the map, and that should be looked at.
Great, thank you. And I will tell you, I am lactose intolerant, so I've had your product, and it's very tasty.
Thank you.
So thanks for coming today. we'll help enlighten some of our colleagues over here. Okay, Laura Flanagan, Patrick Gogan, and Lisa Hansen, or Jim Kramer, whoever would like to come up. Okay, you can get started, please. Okay.
Hello. Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, I am Laura England Flanagan. I am a third-generation Oregon farm woman. I recently inherited our family farm in Eugene alongside my brother. Our family farm started out in the early 50s as a commercial goat dairy, supplying goat's milk for infants. And when Terrific Formula came along in the 60s, the goats went away. And we became a timber, and we segued into becoming a timber family in the 70s. As you all know, timber prices aren't so great right now. And that pain is being felt by many of us here in Oregon. In doing research to see what we could come up with as an alternative, we took a look at hemp growing and determined that our soil and our microclimate might be a fit out on Lorraine Highway. In doing our research, I'm hearing conservative estimates 2 seconds ago that we import close to $250 million of industrial hemp into these United States each year from China and Canada to be used for a myriad of products. Not to belabor what others have just testified, but we use it at hemp, everything from pharmaceuticals and our food to car doors in Detroit are made. Think of what we could do in our great state of Oregon with that kind of money if it was licensed and taxed. We need to think about the jobs we could and will create here in Oregon that would be the ultimate green jobs. I know this group knows the bullet points about industrial hemp ad nauseum. Growing industrial hemp for our family is honestly economical. I need a crop. a good rotation crop, so that I can continue to keep that family farm going. And I have three daughters I'd like to pass it on to so that they can make their agricultural choices for the next 30 years. As a third generation Oregon farm woman, I thank you for your time today and urge passage of Senate Bill 676.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Goggin, I'm representing Vote Hemp. It's a national advocacy organization for the passage of industrial hemp. I'd just like to add to a few of the points that have been raised here today, specifically initially regarding law enforcement concerns. Just to clarify Representative Monson's testimony, when male hemp plants cross-pollinate with female marijuana plants, it causes the flowering tops, more commonly known as the buds, to go to seed. So while the THC content within those flowering tops may still be the same in that current crop, it'll go to seed and cause the drug element essentially to be devalued. So that's an important concept to understand. Just to reiterate, while there may have been some very small problems with in terms of law enforcement in Canada early on, it has been not an issue whatsoever. If you'll talk to unofficially talk to Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they'll tell you the same thing. With respect to the federal-state conflict, it's important to note that what we anticipate is that the initial federal policy shift will be to leave it to the states to decide what to do on this issue and to regulate it themselves. And that's why it's important today for Oregon to put in place laws that will be regulating the growth of industrial hemp, so when the policy does shift, that it'll be ready to go, just like North Dakota is doing right now. With regards to yields, Representative Monson addressed the dryland yields. It's my understanding on dryland it'd be between 800 and 900 pounds per acre, and we're looking at under irrigation, which a lot of the state is under irrigation, 1,200 to 1,500 pounds per acre. And finally, what I really like to emphasize is that policy in the United States around industrial hemp needs to shift to agriculture. This is an agricultural issue. This is not a criminal justice issue. It needs to move away from the 1930s hysteria into the common era of the 21st century, into common sense policy. And I'd also just entertain any questions that the committee might have, and I appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Side has been awfully quiet over here.
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming here today and sharing your testimony. And last but not least, we have the department here that would like to share their thoughts, and I'm sure we have some questions for them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Jim Kramer, who's the administrator of our Commodity Inspection Division. The agency has provided you some written testimony. Many of the issues that we've identified in the written testimony have come up already in the testimony prior. We're prepared to visit about how the agency might go about administering a program, if that is something you would like to visit about, and available for questions.
Okay, why don't you just, if you could briefly talk about, we have your handout here, and obviously it's done in a half a dozen other states, so certainly be interested to hear how it would be done here, and obviously if it's done in other states, there's probably no reason we can't be doing it here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Kramer, Administrator of the Commodity Inspection Division. I think as we look through this bill and put together some of the testimony, it's not an unfamiliar process for us to work together, setting up rules to handle, administer the law. And we see this one being handled very similarly. We would set up an advisory board and advisory committee, work through the process of setting rules to administer the program. That being said, it's kind of a new ground for us, and we're not sure all what we would end up with, how long the process would take, but we're prepared to do that.
And I do have a question for you. I see your note down here about irrigation concern about water requirements, and we heard from Senator Nelson that they're interested in this because it could be a dry land crop. I guess if you can share your experience about that, how well, and I'm assuming the yield would be different whether it's an irrigated crop or not. And then it sounds like I'm concerned about it supplanting other higher, higher yield, but higher, priced crops. And we just heard that, it's being sold at 80 cents a pound and actually that's in North Dakota. I don't know what it would go for here. So if you want to talk a little bit about the market elements, I think that would be helpful. And irrigation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the department has spent some time over the last several days looking into this and going back and looking at previous studies that have been done, and that is the reference to the OSU study that is, I think, 11 years old.
Yeah.
They were, for us as much, just reference to bring to the committee of some of the challenges that could be out there and differences in yields. We have not done an exhaustive search in any way at looking at what yields are between dry land and irrigated farms in any recent time. It was merely put there as reference. And in terms of looking at market and market price, we're learning along with you all about this in terms of it, the new opportunities that are out there for hemp in the marketplace.
Okay. And did you want to comment? I see that you have, as far as the illegal marijuana concerns about that. Did you look into what other states are doing?
Dan Hilburn has done some research. For us, it was a matter of pointing out that there is a nexus with the federal and state law. There could be some challenges with that, and how those need to be worked out, I think, are beyond our current knowledge of what would need to happen.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Przanski, Senator Boquist.
Yeah. And Lisa, I guess what I just want to follow up on, based on this last one, we do realize that we do have asset forfeiture laws in this state, and that if a farmer was foolish enough to actually try to grow marijuana in the middle of a industrial hemp field, they could, in fact, be sanctioned for that by losing hundreds of thousands of dollars in farm equipment and any other type of apparatus, including their land, if they were caught and convicted. Is that an outcome that is possible?
Chair and members of the committee, I don't know that we're prepared to answer all of the legal potentials that exist out there. And our testimony, basically written in here, is to act as if those issues would be resolved. And then what would we do to act as an agency that would administer the program? So I couldn't answer your question to that. I know that as that for the agency, that we would have to have those questions answered internally, and we would do that probably through the rulemaking process.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Przanski.
Yeah, and all I just want to say is that, seeing that you made some notation as to the potential of illegal activity, I just assumed that you had done the other part of the homework as to what would be the way of, let's say, remedying that that's already built into the our state laws.
Okay. Well, we would certainly look into that, and we would ask you to follow up with that. So I appreciate that you haven't had time to do that yet. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the department here. I'm looking at the Congressional Research Report from the federal government, and it indicates that 14 states have actually passed laws for this. 28 states have entered into passed laws calling for economic and production studies to be done. In addition to that, the organization I don't belong to, that the rest of you do to, which is what the National Conference of State Legislatures, actually adopted a resolution in 2000 asking the federal government to resolve this issue so they could grow the products. And then your organization, Lisa, if you didn't know, the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture heads asked for the same thing. And that was in 2003. I think if we did enough search out there, we'd find that there's plenty of states that have existing laws out there. And technically, for the record, as I don't know, I guess Vote Hemp or whoever it is here would say, is the law presently allows it to be produced. It's just the DEA has not issued any permits. And there is an act before the Congress right now.
Thank you for that clarification, Senator. That was more of a comment than a question. I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments? Okay.
No.
We're going to move on now because I have two other work sessions up, so you could follow up with the members afterwards. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, is there anybody else that didn't testify that would like to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prasansky.
Well, I just want to make sure the committee understands that there are some amendments that I will be proposing that will, in fact, bring it more in line with the other bills that have passed in other states, such as the level of THC and a few other things that have been brought to our attention. The bill that we have before us is one that has been a model that has been used in previous legislatures, and so we're going to refine it based on the experience of North Dakota as well as other states. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Prasansky, and we'll look forward to having you work with our committee staff on that and moving it forward. Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill, where are we? We're on Senate Bill 676. I will now open up a work session on Senate Bill 201. Beth, if you could remind us about this bill and let us know if we have an amendment.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 201 directs the Housing and Community Services Department to establish a program to provide funding for energy efficiency improvements in housing for people with low income and very low income. We heard this bill back on February 12th. Since that time, there has been an amendment that you have in front of you. It's the Dash 1 amendment. Basically, what that's going to be doing is removing the funding allocation, but it would still be allowing the department to disperse grants or loans for specific purposes.
Okay. And we have Richard Matthews. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Also, just briefly for the record, you have an indeterminate fiscal on that.
So if you could, Mr. Matthews, you're from the Department of Housing and Community Services, correct?
Correct.
You could please discuss the amendment and then the fiscal. I think that will be helpful before we take a motion on that. And
yes,
for the
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Richard Matthews. I'm the manager of the Energy Unit with Oregon Housing and Community Services. The energy program with the department provides low-income bill payment assistance and low-income weatherization. Now, the 201-1 amendments that you have in front of you do two things. One, it eliminates the Section 4 of the original bill that that established an appropriation of $4 million of general fund for use of match with other funding. And the second part, it eliminates the establishment of a separate account for this program. We believe, and this was discussed, essentially what this does is accept a reality of Oregon's current economic situation in the state's budget. We've taken out the reference to the general fund, and we believe with recent announcement of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that we will be able to fund at least those items you see in the current bill, items 2 through 5. The item number one, which is essentially a pre-development ability to pay pre-development cost in order to incorporate green and renewable concepts into the engineering, architecture, and design of projects, we are still searching for funding for that. But we are sure that we can fund the remaining 2 through 5. And having this bill will allow us then to start looking for additional funding, other funding sources that can be more comprehensive in terms of addressing 1 through 5. We will not need an appropriation for this bill. This bill is a policy bill that sets up a program. All funding for this bill will be part of our 2009-2011 budget. The limitation will be included in that budget, limitation request. This program will also be tracked through the current accounting system.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that description. I just want to make clear for the committee that this is a bill we heard, about a month and a half ago. The department was requesting $4 million in general fund, which obviously situation here with our budget does not accommodate that. As you've heard, he's taken out eliminating that request by eliminating Section 4 of the bill. We have heard, I will tell you, I sit in the Ways and Means Committee, the subcommittee for the Department of Energy's budget, and we've heard that there is over $38 million in stimulus money through the U.S. Department of Energy for low-income weatherization. And so my understanding is that you will be trying to see if you can receive some of the federal money to do the work that you'd like to do with weatherization of low-income housing. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We had anticipated prior to receiving the U.S. Department of Energy guidelines for the use of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding, we expected it not to be as constrained as it ended up being. So it follows very much the current DOE weatherization program. And although items 1, 2 through 5 can be addressed, it does limit us to an extent to go any further than that for low-income weatherization programs.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I will actually accept a motion, and then we can have a discussion or further questions.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 12, 2009.
Okay, Senator House moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 12, 2009. Is there any discussion or any further questions? Senator Boquist?
Just a point of clarification, make sure I clearly understand. What we're saying is that if federal funds are available from the stimulus or the federal government, then that's how we'll fund Sections 2 through 5, not with general fund dollars.
Correct. Okay, any other questions or discussion? Okay, there's a motion on the table. I will ask if there's any objection. Okay, seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move SB 201 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and request a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay. Senator Hass moves Senate Bill 201 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there... I'll ask the clerk to call the roll for this one.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Krasowski?
Aye.
Senator Hass?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Chair DeGutter?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And the bill will be sent as amended to the floor. Is there anybody that would like to carry this bill? I know you don't want to.
Okay.
Senator Przanski, I don't think you've had the opportunity to carry many bills out of this committee, so it's only fair. I've had to carry a lot of yours. Thank you for volunteering. With that, Senator Przanski will be the carrier for Senate Bill 201. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 201. We have one more work session, colleagues, and that is on Senate Bill 79. We'll open up the work session on Senate Bill 79, and Beth, provide an update, and then I will provide some comments before we have some folks come up and talk about it.
Senate Bill 79 was heard on January 22nd, and since that time there's been a work group. So the amendment before you is a result of that work group labeled the Dash 2s. The amendment replaces the text of the bill, creating a task force on energy performance scores, requires that the governor appoint 9 members to the task force that represent specific fields, requires the task force study and evaluate energy use in new and existing commercial residential buildings. It requires them to create a voluntary energy performance scoring system in time for the Department of Energy to adopt rules to implement the voluntary program no later than July 1st, 2010. In addition, it requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services in consultation with the appropriate advisory boards to adopt, amend, and administer a REACH code separate from the state building code. And the building code section of this act becomes operative January 1st, 2010.
And do we have a fiscal yet?
We do not at this time.
Okay, so we won't be able to move this today. Well, first of all, colleagues, I just wanted to say that there's a lot of work that has gone into these amendments. I first want to thank all of the folks who were on either of the two work groups. There were 2 separate work groups that met multiple times, and I appreciate the hard work of everybody who contributed that, including our committee administrator, Beth Herzog, who staffed both of those committees. I'm not sure how you kept them all on track, but you did an excellent job. So we're going to hear from some of the committee, the work group members who are involved with that, and I am going to ask a couple folks to come up. Dave Bantoff from the Governor's Office, Mark Long from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and Brady Peaks from the Oregon Department of Energy, and then I'll have a few other folks come up afterwards. Mark, when I'll have David Vantoff start off, since this was and still is the governor's bill. We've amended it quite a bit, so certainly any comments that you have be appreciated.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Vantoff from the governor's office, for the record. Yeah, I'll be real brief at this hour, and hopefully some folks are going to come and testify, but I just want to reiterate really what you said in terms of the work group process. This started as an interim effort to the governor's energy efficiency work group. The concept came out of that. It was molded quite a bit in that process, molded quite a bit further in the work group process after that. There's been a lot of compromise, I think, made by the various stakeholders in what's going to be coming before you. Mark Long is going to walk through some of the final proposed amendments that have been coming in, even I think as of today. So we're going to have some final tweaks to the bill for the committee to finally review, hopefully early next week if we can get them out of legislative council. But just wanted to thank everybody for their efforts to get to yes on a good bill, and something that's going to really help move energy efficiency forward in the built environment and both with our building code process and help us move towards lower carbon building.
Great. Thank you, David. Mark?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. We're part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I, too, want to thank committee staff and everybody who participated. We had a lot of meetings, and it's my impression that we do have consensus on the bill. There are some minor adjustments that we need to make, and we will get those in right directly. I think I'll just do a quick overview, turn it over to Brady, and then come back to the building codes pieces that are later part of the bill. A couple things, though. It definitely has two separate parts to the bill. And as we've gone through the work group process and as I've talked to folks, it's really two separate issues. The energy performance scoring system and the building codes pieces, yes, they're in one bill, but they're not necessarily related to each other other than it impacts construction. The other thing that I would like to clarify is that the building codes pieces primarily and related to the energy performance score, there's no retrofitting or automatic upgrading or any of those kinds of things. We've had those questions. How does this apply to my existing building? Am I going to have to upgrade my building? And the answer to that, this does not change the current policy in the state of Oregon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brady to talk about the task force pieces, and then I'll come back, if that's okay, Madam Chair, to talk about the building codes pieces.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brady Peeks. I'm the Building Technologies Manager for the Oregon Department of Energy. And the task force portion of the bill is somewhat of a change from the original language, in that the original language tasked our agency with writing rules to adopt a voluntary rating system, and as well gave us the option of adopting a simplified scoring system that would be a mandatory reporting component at the time of sale. And the amendment, as it comes out, does create a governor-appointed task force to come up with recommendations on adopting a rating system. And so it doesn't have the direct impact of a mandatory component for reporting at the time of sale. It's definitely a good combination of all the interests involved. That this gives us something that we can actually examine the topic much more closely and then determine where to go with it in the future.
Okay, and Brady, I see on page 3, subsection 11, I guess it's section 1, subsection 11, that both your agency and DCBS would be providing staff support.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. All right, and Mark, if you want to...
Sure.
Over the remainder
Madam
of the
Chair,
sections.
I'll talk about sections 5 on, which are the building codes pieces, and can just kind of highlight. The main part of the building codes is we're creating greater emphasis on energy efficiency, which is all good. What we do is we reset or bump up our commercial and residential codes. In our residential codes, we're going to ask for an increase of 10 to 15%, and in our commercial codes, 15 to 25%. Those are the ranges that we discussed with the various stakeholders. One thing that you ought to be aware, on the commercial side, as a result of passage of this bill and implementation back in my office, this will align our organization and the state for federal stimulus dollars related to energy efficiency as well. As part of the Recovery Act, states have to achieve a certain standard, and we will be able to do that as once this is completed. The bill also contains a very unique feature called the REACH code. There's been some confusion around this. I want to clarify. This is a voluntary code, and the purpose is we want to take the latest and greatest standards and technology technology that's available, proven technology and standards that's available on the national level, put those into a code that the state then makes available for developers, contractors, subcontractors, and building owners to use if they choose to. It's very clear in the bill that it's optional. It is a choice for them, and the purpose of that is whenever you deal with codes or whenever you want to do something that's in addition to the building code, you have to go through an exception process at the local level. And what we're doing is taking that out of the system. We're going to adopt these standards ahead of time. If you want to build in excess of the building code, have a higher energy efficient building, you will now have a code that will be recognized in all 130 jurisdictions statewide, and you'll have assurances that it will be accepted at the local level because the state has gone through the act of reviewing the standards. We think that's going to really help with predictability and providing choice to our contractors. The other thing the bill does is it asks us to develop a schedule of when we're going to adopt our code amendments, which we think is useful so that contractors and designers can kind of see where we're headed as we go through this process. We consult with our various boards, and there's off-ramps if necessary if we can't meet the schedule that we set ahead of time. Again, that's just trying to let folks know what to expect out of the code adoption process down the road. And as I said, it's the last thing. The bump up or the reset of the codes, which is the last part of the bill, we think that's going to be very useful to, again, position Oregon and get those increases of 10 to 15 on the residential by 2012 and 15 to 25 on the commercial side by 2012 as well. With that, there are some minor amendments or clarifications that folks have asked us for since the bill came out, or the amendments came out on Tuesday, and we've had other folks ask to be part of the task force, which is good. They're interested in the issue, so we might be going from 9 to potentially 13 members. And clarification on making sure that the voluntary system is that we're using as a basis the existing systems that are out there. We're working on that. And then some minor clarifications around the building code pieces to make sure that folks understand our current 7 advisory boards will be wrapped into this system and that we're not changing anything related to the building code.
So, I trust that you'll be working with Beth to make sure those amendments get in a timely manner.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? We actually don't have, as you've heard, we still have some more amendments and we don't have the paperwork on this, so we won't be moving it today. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We have a few folks that asked to come up and provide some comments. That was John Chandler, Sean Jillians, and Drew Higgendorm. I know you've been waiting throughout this anxiously. There will be hemp ice cream for you out there, though.
Yeah.
Senator Prezonsky already ate yours.
I don't think Chandler and I need any, so
speak for yourself.
Okay, who'd like to go first? John?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of the -2 prime amendments to Senate Bill 79. The amendments after the work group process came out with making this bill much better. The discussions over the last couple of days, I think, will improve it even more. I really appreciate the willingness of everybody involved to bend where bending was appropriate and to work towards a common goal of making the built environment even more energy efficient. I'd just again like to state for the record that we are already going forward, the home builders are, with the Energy Performance Program. We'll be rolling that out here shortly. We're hiring, actually doing interviews tomorrow to hire a green building person on our staff. We're excited about the opportunities presented by this bill, and we hope we move it forward expeditiously.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments.
Scott Berry, also with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I just wanted to add that we appreciate the work that that Building Codes has put into this. There were changes that needed to be made as recently as this afternoon, and certainly just getting together with those folks and working through that stuff. I think getting to where we were all trying to go in the first place, but as we all know, sometimes when the amendments come out, they don't necessarily match where everybody thought we were going. So appreciate their work in this, and look forward to supporting the bill.
Thank you. Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Just wanted to echo the comments, thanking staff and the chair for her patience. And this work group process, I think we had a lot of good open discussions in there. I look forward to future open discussions about as this moves forward. And also want to just thank the agencies and the governor's office for their work as well in the work group process, and we are supportive of the Hand and Growth -2, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Drew?
Chair Dean Felder, committee members, Drew Hagedorn here on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, also in support of the Dash 2s. We very much appreciated the work group process and everybody involved in that, the governor's office, you, Madam Chair, staff, et cetera, the Building Codes Division. We have one of the little tweaks, Section 6, and we're working with the division to implement that and incorporate it in the amendments that were referenced. So we're happy to support the bill and looking forward to building more energy-efficient commercial structures.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for these folks? Okay. We have one more person. Thank you very much, and thanks for your input and assistance with the work group. Bill Cross, just got a note. And I also want to mention Bob Shipwreck with the building trades could not be here today. He's out of town. But he did call me and wanted me to make sure that the committee members knew that they also support the Dash 2s, and they wanted to just share that with the committee.
Committee Chair, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Building Owners and Managers Association, BOMA, and I appreciate the opportunity to have worked on the work groups in their behalf, and the final product is definitely an improvement in at least in terms of trying to accommodate some of the concerns that commercial building owners have. One remaining concern, and I don't know if we can address this through the Building Codes Division, either by rule or statute, but as it relates to tenant improvements, it will be very expensive to comply with the ASHRAE standards and the 15% to 25% reduction that would be required. And every 5 years, or it depends on buildings, but they go through, they'll make tenant improvements either for new tenants or existing tenants, and those can be, this could require new HVAC equipment, for example.
Okay, you know what, I'm going to ask Mark Long. Mark, do you want to come up? Because this did not come up in the work group that I recall. This issue. So, Mark, if you can address this, or
sure.
If not, I'm going to ask you guys offline and then come
sure.
back and
Madam Chair, for the record, again, Mark Long. The issue may have come up when at some point after the work group or whatnot, and so in Section 9 we added language to accommodate BOMA's concern, and it talks about new construction, reconstruction, alteration, or repair of non-residential buildings. That is the exact language out of the State Building Code, and the Building Code for since 35 years kind of dictates when you have to upgrade and when you don't have to upgrade. The general version is that if you change your occupancy type from warehouse to residential living, then you would have to upgrade, but simple tenant improvements and those kinds of things, you don't. If you change your furnace, though, you have to use a new modern furnace. If you change your window, you've got to put in a window, etc. But it does not require upgrades when you simply do tenant improvements unless you change significant occupancy. Those standards have been in the building code, again, for 35 years. Local governments have been implementing that, and this does not change any of that process that's been going on currently.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Does that address your concern?
Yes, I believe it does, Chair.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who would like to come up, comment on this amendment before we close the work session?
What the hell?
Quickly, though, because I have another meeting that I'm... yeah.
I get the message.
Okay. Well, if you do, you can have a minute.
I have a minute.
You have a minute.
Okay. I was almost a yes.
It is almost.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
Joe Resnick from the IBW, 48 in Portland, Oregon. I've been a member of the Energy Trust of Oregon Conservation Advisory Council, working on this kind of stuff off and on for years, and want to make sure that you all know we're 100% behind this bill as it stands. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 79. I will mention that because we don't have the paperwork, as you heard, we have a couple more amendments. We're going to carry this over. We hope to have the paperwork by next Tuesday, so that's our plan. I'm hoping that the legislative fiscal folks are listening.
Put it on the record.
And that we will plan to have a work session on this next Tuesday if we have the paperwork, which we certainly plan to do. So that'll be posted as well, correct? Okay. That'll be carried over till next Tuesday. With that, We've finished our business, and we'll close the Senate Committee on Environment.